to you. Thanks for joining me today. There's a number of posts that have been going up on the Earth Ancients Facebook page, and I just want to mention a couple here real quickly. They're always of interest, and not only do we have a great group of people posting that are regular members, I get a number of authors and researchers post regular content to the Facebook Earth Ancients group page. And a couple of days ago, I was sent a photograph of a actual model that was built based on a Hindu aircraft. And apparently, about 7,000 years ago, in a Hindu script, there was the story of a ship that was sighted and described in enough detail that today's modern engineers were able to reproduce it. And in this image, you can see it was posted on the 17th. The title is Fascinating Ancient Craft, and it's a bronze-colored craft that has a number of wings and propellers, and it's shaped almost like a submarine. In fact, one of the comments that was made is that it's shaped after the submarine that appears in the movie League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is funny because there was a lot of really cool equipment and both land and air and sea craft that was designed for that movie. But take a look at this. This is quite amazing because there are a lot of references in the Vedic tradition and various scripts of ancient Vedic culture of aircraft, of land craft, and this craft is amazing. And it doesn't go into quite a lot of detail. The article doesn't go into enough detail about where the engineering was done, who was the craftsperson. It just appears as part of a team effort to do this. And to my mind, when we start seeing these images, these engineered images of craft that came out of the ancient world, it really makes you wonder. It makes you think twice about, you know, changes in the earth that may have wiped out a previous civilization. Now we know Graham Hancock's new book does talk about that. We know that Fingerprints of the Gods does refer to that, and there's numerous authors who speak about civilizations that were as sophisticated as we are today, or more so. And so this is an image of a craft that was flying in the earth, you know, 7,000 plus years ago. And it's a warship. And it's just amazing to look at. It looks like it seats about three or four people. There's one main person in the cockpit, but down in the hull of the ship, there's more people that could be actually moving around. So take a look at that. It's one of the first things I want to mention. And then the other thing is that just this morning, the 19th, an article was posted on a number of discoveries that have been found in the Ukraine and other parts of Russia, which have what appears to be these road tracks, fossilized road tracks that are extremely old. And a number of Russian geologists have basically said that it's not in Russia. These are in central Turkey, these road tracks. The unique part about these road tracks are they've been analyzed, and what's unique are a number of things. Number one is they're extremely old, millions of years old. And what's unique is they have the same wheelbase as a modern-day RV, multi-terrain vehicle. They're advanced in their width. Their depth shows that they had a certain amount of weight that is equal to what our SUVs would be today in the U.S. And the analysis reveals that they are made from some kind of a vehicle, a land vehicle. Now, the analysis goes to the point as to claim that these must have been some kind of movement because the patterns are weight-bearing over a long distance of hundreds of feet. And this at one time was a mud or a very soft surface that has crystallized or has fossilized to the point where they can actually analyze the tracks that are within these grooves. And it's kind of mind-blowing when you think that, you know, a million years ago there was a Land Rover in Turkey. And it kind of leads us to wonder, you know, maybe we have our history wrong. And I'm constantly harping on this, that as well as a number of authors, that there is appearance, there are greater evidence now that there have been other civilizations on the planet that had engineering and scientific abilities that allowed them to produce and create land movement, air movement vehicles. And this is just another example of these craft, of these machines. Could be just like what we have today. You know, time cycles around. The SUV, we're so comfortable driving our family around, off-roading, on-roading the vehicles, may have been invented millions of years ago. And this is some very startling evidence that has recently been posted and is on our Facebook page. If you go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, and go to the group page, the title I gave this series of photos is Ancient Land Rovers, because it's an all-terrain vehicle is what the scientists suspect, and they actually provide the analytics behind it. Now, what they don't show is any tracks. Like today's wheels, rubber tires have tracks cut into the rubber to give them more traction. We don't see that. So they had another way of doing it back a million years ago. Anyhow, always something for thought. And that's what we're all about, is to question not only our history, but to question who was here before us. And is this a continual cycle? So check it out, Earth Ancients group page on Facebook. And it's kind of amazing, actually. When Zachariah Sitchin introduced the notion of hybrids created from an ancient civilization known as the Anunnaki, it kind of made everyone think about where we had come from and if we were offspring of an ancient race. In his book, The 12th Planet, he really caused a major stir. When he would go and talk in conferences, and actually I had him at a couple of conferences, it was always about, you know, where are the remnants of this ancient race of the Anunnaki? And since that time, authors like Michael Tellinger in his book Slave, Species of the God, has said in certain aspects that the Anunnaki have morphed. And they are in high places. They're within the government, and they're still controlling us in a certain way. He goes on to discuss various elements in the government, and most of what Michael writes about is pretty negative, leading one to think that we're being controlled. But my guest today, Nick Redfern, who we've had before, Nick's a prolific writer, and he writes about a lot of different things on UFOs and the Bigfoot, and he's just a prolific writer, and it's really great to have him on the program. But, you know, what is the reference to our to ancient aliens? Did they leave a mark in some way that identifies their handiwork? And in this new book that Nick has written called Bloodline of the Gods, he looks at our origins, and he looks at a specific group of people that he has identified as Rh negatives. And, I mean, the book is filled with some amazing references. It gets into quite a bit of alien abductions and the whole phenomenon behind abductions. But we're going to talk today about his thinking behind the specific group and where it fits into the world today. Nick, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Chris.
Great to have you with us.
Thanks a lot.
What sparked your interest in writing about this group of people? There must have been some trigger point. You're constantly researching, you know, UFO topics, alien topics, things like that. This is a real specific area that you uncovered. What was the trigger point?
Well, basically, what it was that, you know, over the years, you sort of make friends with a lot of people in the UFO subject. And, excuse me, over time, not very often, but now and again, I would hear from people, whether, you know, directly from witnesses, you know, sending me Facebook messages or whatever, or from authors and researchers, snippets of stories about how, you know, they'd interviewed an abductee and it turned out they were Rh negative and they knew somebody else who was Rh negative, had weird experiences. And then a friend of mine named Mike Cleland, who's been fascinated by the whole abduction angle for years and has done a lot of really good research into the phenomenon associated things, turns out that he had his blood checked and he was Rh negative. And so a few things like this started to build up into a bigger picture. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. You know, it almost sounds like the number of people who are Rh negative and who are either interested in the subject, drawn to it, or have had experiences seems to be higher than normal, because, you know, I was getting more reports of Rh negative blood people than just, you know, nobody bringing it up in the first place. It was almost as if people were driven to find out, you know, what their blood group was. So I thought, well, I'll have a look around on the internet and, you know, and books and see what's available. And, you know, you can find a lot of regular medical columns and articles about Rh negative blood, and you can find a number of UFO themed ones. But basically that was it. And when I'm sort of looking for new ideas for books to write about, you want to try and do something that hasn't really been done before to give, you know, the reader value for money. And so I thought, well, why not try and dig into this deeper and deeper? And that's what I did. And the more I dug into it, the more I found threads that sort of expanded into the distant past, but also into the present as well. And, you know, in other words, there are all these little pieces of a jigsaw scattered around that when you started to put them together, there was a story worth telling. So that was really what sort of prompted it to occur.
Okay. Tons of really cool references to sightings, to actual alien abductions, things like that. But the foundation is Sitchin's Anunnaki, and it looks to me that you did your thorough homework and pulled a lot and extracted a lot of information based on the Anunnaki. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always important that, you know, you go back to original sources and, you know, sort of the original, some of the English translations, you know, aside from just the sort of ancient astronaut books that have been written in relation to the Anunnaki, but actually go back to the original stories, you know, and English translations, that kind of thing. But then also what I did was to sort of review, you know, literally pretty much I would say close to all the books that have been written on the Anunnaki. You know, and obviously you don't want to you don't want to just copy somebody else. So what I did was to go back and look at what I felt were the important threads that related specifically to the Rh angle, Rh negative angle, and then use that as a springboard to do further investigations, new investigations into the ties. So in other words, the book, I mean, the book's like 250 pages, but I think only sort of 30 or so relate to the Anunnaki. And the reason being, because, you know, I sort of want to stress that the book isn't a book about the Anunnaki. You know, that's a small part of it, but I sort of use that 30 or so pages to go back to the beginning and then expand upon what we know today as in terms of scientific data to add to the you know, the original stories that we have, and then try and build a bigger picture as to how this phenomenon of Anunnaki interaction and meddling, if you like, which might be the right term to use, potentially is still carrying on today with the whole abduction law. So, in other words, it's not an ancient aliens book, but it uses that as a springboard to take us through, you know, early times, through the Middle Ages, and right up to the present.
Okay. Do you? Is it your belief that these Rh negative beings are of an age referred to in Sitchin's book as 400,000 years old, or is it more of a newer phenomenon?
Well, you know, I mean, the big problem we have, and I point this out in the book, is that the further we go back into time, the more and more it becomes sort of foggy when this happened or that happened. Mm-hmm. And that's why I try and, you know, I actually start the book with nothing to do with UFOs and ancient aliens or anything. I talk about, you know, the nature of Rh negative blood and exactly what it is and how it comes to be and why only like a small percentage of the population, which is, you know, depending on the statistics, is sort of roughly around about 8 to 12, 13, 14% of the population are Rh negative. And what that basically means is that sort of 80 plus, 85, 87% of the population has Rh, they're Rh positive. And the basically it comes to what's called the rhesus factor from the rhesus monkey. It's a protein. And Rh negative people lack this protein. Now, given the fact that, you know, we're all human and we all have this ancient lineage, you know, according at least to the theory of evolution, why is it that we're not all Rh positive? Why should a small percentage of the population be different? So that's basically how I start the book. And then I demonstrate that certain people, they have a higher percentage of Rh negatives than other people. And the most notable example is the Basque people of Spain and portions of France. Their figures are anywhere from sort of 45 to 55% of Rh negatives. And what's interesting is that in the areas where the Basques proliferated, prior to that you had heavy concentrations of Cro-Magnon man. And in other parts of Europe and the world where Cro-Magnon man also proliferated, we also have higher percentages today of Rh negatives. This sort of gives right, and there's no doubt when you look at the Basques, they have an like a unique appearance. They have sort of like a broader, more pronounced forehead. They're bulkier, not because they bulk up deliberately. That's their natural frame, and they have been, you know, offered as like the sort of closest present day descendant, if you like, of the Cro-Magnons, and so. Because of the, you know, the proliferation of Rh negatives within the Basques and in other areas where we find the Cro-Magnons, the chances are extremely high that Cro-Magnon man was Rh negative. Now, again, that begs the question, why or how? You know, when we had all these sort of early men like Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, etc., how come this one was different? And we know Cro-Magnon man was, you know, was a very intriguing creature, a bigger brain than ours, highly evolved, understood the nature of death, was extremely gifted artists. You know, they were highly advanced. They weren't sort of dumb cavemen, you know, dragging his wife back to the cave by the hair, you know, that you see in these typical stereotypical cartoons or whatever. So that's what I try and do, is lay the foundation with a credible example of how what Rh negative blood is, and how it relates to people today and how we can make a direct connection into the distant past with the Cro-Magnons. And then is when I sort of bring in this issue of, was Cro-Magnon man sort of genetically altered from something more inferior, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get into this Rh negative blood. Explain what the difference is of what makes it unique, the blood itself.
Well, yeah. Well, sure. I mean, there's actually a number of unique issues relating not just to the blood, but also physical and even sort of psychological issues, you know, are slightly different. But basically, the four basic blood groups are AB, AB, and O. And, you know, even as late as the American Civil War and immediate aftermath, the nature of the different blood groups wasn't really very well known. That's why on the battlefield in the Civil War, literally thousands of people died, not necessarily from the bullet wounds or, you know, sword wounds, but because they were injected with the wrong sort of blood. Nobody knew then, you know, that B people need B blood, A people need A blood. And but basically, the classifications come from what are called the antigens of a person's blood cells, which are proteins found on the surface of the cells themselves and which combat bacteria and viruses. Now, nearly all of the human population has these proteins on their cells, and they're called the Rh-positive people. The small percentage that don't have this protein are the Rh-negative. So, in other words, it's not so much that they're different, it's what they're lacking. They're lacking the protein, the Rh, the rhesus protein, that the rest of us can be identified by. And, of course, that begs the question, again, why that should be the case. We're all human. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, if we're Native American, if we're Chinese, if we're African American or white, you know, we're all human. So why is it that a small percentage of us are different? So that basically describes the nature of Rh negative blood. Now, there are actually there's one major hazard with being Rh negative. If, say, for example, hypothetically, you have a woman who's pregnant and she's Rh positive, let's so we say, and the father is Rh negative. Now, if, you know, the woman becomes pregnant, you know, the fetus starts to grow, and a lot of people don't realize, but the blood of the mother and the blood of the baby don't actually mix. You know, certainly that the mother's body feeds the baby, but the blood does not combine. Now, sometimes if a mother has to have this procedure, you know, that they need to examine the fetus, etc., and they insert a needle and take blood from the fetus, if any of that blood gets into the mother's bloodstream and you have a cross, then in the mother's bloodstream then starts to contain Rh negative and Rh positive blood, as incredible as it sounds, the mother's body actually tries to kill the fetus. And the only way to combat it, fortunately today we have drugs that actually prevent the process of, you know, killing the fetus from occurring. Mm-hmm. In a least worse scenario, it can cause severe anemia in the baby, which again can cause massive problems as well. So it's almost as if the mother's body views the fetus as something alien, you know, and I don't mean that sort of, you know, in terms of a pun or anything like that. That's literally how it views it, as something that needs to be gotten rid of. So, you know, we have weird things like that as well.
Is there something in the physical traits? I mean, you explained the Basque people, their physicality is different. They seem to be more of a stronger physical specimen, and you actually describe it in your book. But is there something else that makes Rh negative people unique in their both psychological and physical makeup that is different from the rest of us?
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things is that in terms of the spinal column, a small percentage of the population at random is actually born with an extra vertebra And, you know, for the most part, it doesn't actually cause any issues or problems as such. Most people may not even know it unless, you know, they have to have surgery on their back or whatever. But there's a higher percentage of people who fall into the Rh negative range who have this extra vertebra. In other words, it's not just a random amount like it is in the rest of the population. There are also sometimes abnormalities with the ribs as well, with the rib cage. On top of that, for some reason we don't really understand, Rh negatives typically have slightly lower than normal blood pressure, which is good. You know, you don't want it too low so you're passing out when you stand up, but actually slightly below the regular figure of 120 over 80 is good. You know, if you're like 110 over 70, that's really good. And that's the category the Rh negatives fall into. They also seem to be far more, have a greater ability to withstand effects from viruses and things like that. So it's almost as if they've been sort of synthesized to be, I won't say like a super race, you know, I don't want to make it sound racist or anything like that. That's not my intention. But it's almost as if they've been, somebody's tried to synthesize them to be something that can be more, you can withstand more, that is less likely to fall sick, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as I said at the very beginning, when I was doing the research, one of the things I found was the sort of sheer proliferation of people interested in the subject or experienced it who are Rh negative. So in other words, people who are Rh negative, maybe not even knowing they're Rh negative, feel drawn to subjects like UFOs, ancient astronauts, and so on. And this gets to something I talk about in the book, sort of the issue of inherited memory. You know, are we all, or at least, you know, the Rh negatives, are they possibly encoded with fragments of deeply buried memories, you know, that may have been sort of, the idea of inherited memory, you know, is very controversial. The scenario of you can actually inherit fragments of literal memories through birth, you know, from your parents. And the theory is that that might explain why Rh negatives are drawn to these phenomena, because, as I said, deeply encoded in their DNA somewhere are these subconscious memories of, hey, we're different and this is what we're connected to.
Yeah, you reference Eric von Däniken as a Rh negative in the book, and I was like, really?
Yeah, well,
the father of ancient aliens is Rh negative.
I mean, this is a weird thing. Is that, I mean, I have an entire chapter on this issue of inherited memory, and no less than sort of three really well-known authors who've written extensively on ancient astronauts, ancient mysteries. First, Eric von Däniken, who, you know, without who there would probably not, you know, although people had written books on ancient astronauts before him, like Raymond Drake, for example, and Maurice Jessop, it was certainly von Däniken with Chariots of the Gods in 68 who put the subject on the map, you know, on a worldwide scale and never really went away again. Now, as I said, Eric von Däniken's Rh negative, Brad Steiger's Rh negative, who's again, written extensively on ancient mysteries, as was Robert Anton Wilson. Now, Robert Anton Wilson in the 1970s got very deeply interested in the whole ancient astronauts issue and believed that at one point he was literally getting channeled messages from entities in the double star system of Sirius. And a lot of these messages were connected to ancient Egypt mysteries and things like this. So, you know, is it a coincidence or is it more that three formative players in the ancient astronaut, ancient mysteries camp just happen to be Rh negative? And von Däniken, again, you know, being the major figure in this field, he happens to be Rh negative.
It's fascinating. What have you discovered is the tie-in that makes you think that these individuals have been enhanced or have been genetically bred individuals? Is it specifically the story of the Anunnaki and their who was it? Enki was the one who was the medical officer who did the work. Is it that
Well,
lead
I
that
mean,
is?
yeah, I mean, it starts with that. I mean, I've tried to sort of do it chronologically because I think for the ease of reading the story, it's better to do it that way than just, you know, randomly have a chapter on modern day abductions, then sort of swing back to the Anunnaki. You know, it'd look out of place. So I've primarily done everything chronologically because I think it's the easiest approach to take. Now, you know, I think the important thing about all these stories, whether it's the Anunnaki, whether it's biblical accounts, which I also touch upon in the book, what we find, you know, again and again are these stories of higher entities coming down and, you know, hear these stories of, you know, mating with the humans and that kind of thing. Then we hear these stories like the men of renown and things like this, and human beings having extended lifespans and stories of the giants. It's almost as if somehow at some point some sort of explosion of genetic manipulation occurred, and we had suddenly the blossoming of these, you know, as I said, the giants, the men of renown, things like that. And I think it's easy. Well, I'd say I think it's very easy, and not even a stretch, to place all of this into a UFO ancient astronaut context, and particularly, you know, when you look at the stories of the Anunnaki. I mean, for me, that's sort of a, you know, a really eye-opening way in which to, you know, to interpret their actions and the legends surrounding them. You know, you really can place it into sort of a UFO context. And I sort of point out, you know, the sudden surfacing of some of these ancient types of humans and the fact that they weren't sort of the dumb, stupid brutes that, you know, we're told when we're kids or whatever, or like I said, you're seeing cartoons and old TV shows. There's nothing like that at all. You look at the cave paintings in France that the Cro-Magnons did, I mean, they would rival anything you would see, you know, in an art gallery of the last couple of hundred years, you know, like really incredible paintings. We know that they, you know, had like a spirituality. They understood the nature of death. They were, you know, they were skilled hunters and farmers. And for that reason, my view is that, you know, we can put the scenarios together. The advancement of these entities combined with the so-called gods coming down and playing deep roles, not just within the human race, but actually altering it. You know, and I talk about things like, for example, the story of Adam and Eve, you know, the idea of Eve being sort of created, so to speak, from Adam's rib. You know, in the Bible, it talks about how God actually placed Adam into like a great sleep. And it sounds like, you know, somebody gets taken to hospital and they're anesthetized. And yeah. I mean, the problem with a lot of the biblical stories is when people take them literally. But to me, the idea potentially of extracting bone, or actually another, if you look at the original translation, the rib is actually the same term for the side of the body. So in other words, we could be talking about, you know, DNA and cells being taken, and what have you got? Some sort of highly advanced cloning process, which, you know, over the years and centuries and oral tradition becomes simplified into, oh, God took Adam's rib and lo and behold, Eve suddenly appears. You know, it's not that simple. Mm-hmm. But if you look at those kind of accounts as being a distortion of early medical experimentation, but highly advanced, which the people of that era, you know, would only have a bare understanding of and wrote about it in ways that they could. Again, I think all of this links together into sort of a cohesive pattern, if you like.
What would be the purpose of creating a race of these beings? Would it be that their superior intellect, and by the way, in your book you have a wonderful description of perhaps they have psychic abilities, can maybe perceive things in other dimensions. I mean, they're definitely an enhanced species the way you describe them. Is there a reason that these individuals would walk the earth? Is there something that you've discovered is kind of at the root of their genetic disposition?
Well, you know, I mean, I think one of the areas where a lot of people sort of gravitate to when it comes to Sitchin's research is the whole idea of creating like a worker race, that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, something that would be sort of sturdy, strong, formidable, that, you know, wouldn't fall sick, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, Sitchin talked about how, for example, he had this theory that they were mining for gold because their home planet of Nibiru, its atmosphere was degrading, and that essentially sort of a shield from, you know, a gigantic, you know, an untold body of flakes could actually sort of, you know, prevent the you know, the devastating rays coming through, you know, like the problem we have today with the ozone layer, that sort of thing. But rather than sort of just, you know, parrot fashion, which I don't like to do, you know, Sitchin or anything like that, I looked into the issue of whether such a scenario could actually be achieved. You know, the idea of one day we could actually plug holes in our atmosphere, if necessary, in the same way that Sitchin talked about the Anunnaki doing. And sure enough, I actually stumbled on some really interesting material. Like, for example, in December 2009, the U.S. House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, as it was called, held a hearing on things like climate science, global warming, and also the thinning of the ozone layer. Now, one of the people who was part of the debate was President Obama's science advisor, Dr. John Holdren. Now, he suggested, with a degrading atmosphere already, if it got worse and hotter, that certain pollutants, as he called it, could be released into the atmosphere to help offset the effects of global warming and plugging the holes in the thinning ozone layer. And he said, you know, it might be the planet got to the point where we had such grave side effects that, you know, we would have to just do it. And in the 1970s, the famous physicist Edward Teller, he actually came up with the idea of flooding the Earth's upper atmosphere with particles of heavy metals, again, to provide like a shield-type defense in the event that the ozone layer thinned even more. So, in other words, what I did was, again, to sort of comment on Sitchin's theories, but then point out we're not reliant on someone's translation of old texts. We can actually see that today, ironically, we're actually planning for possibly having to do what they may have done hundreds of thousands of years ago with an Earth-based slave species, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, those references to our atmosphere are quite startling. You got me thinking about the various types of government officials / dictators, or as some call them, the royals. And I'm beginning to wonder, after reading part of your book, if this interbreeding among the royals was in a way to kind of keep this bloodline pure, although the ramifications and the after effects of interbreeding can cause a tremendous amount of genetic defects. But do you think that's a possibility, why some of the interbreeding of the royals took place? It goes back to possibly the dynastic Egyptians to keep this Rh negative in place and all the way into the Elizabethan period.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting scenario and a viable one. And the reason why, I think, you know, if you look at the stories of the Anunnaki, you know, and their interactions with the human race, and then the day comes when they're gone. Well, you know, if you wanted to, in some fashion, continue to hold sway over the planet, what better way than to sort of continue to rule, but rule by proxy, if you like. Now, that's not to say that all the Rh negatives on the planet secretly know that they're aliens. They, you know, that would be bizarre and absurd. They don't. You know, we're all just, you know, unless you find out, you're not going to know. It's not like you have clandestine meetings with all the other Rh negatives or anything like that. But I do wonder if, you know, the idea of trying to continue the bloodline, as I said, to rule by proxy. And who knows, maybe we would try and do something like that. You know, if we ever went to another world and, you know, we wanted to leave our mark there, maybe we wouldn't just sort of leave our mark with stories and technology. We might want to, you know, leave our mark literally. And in which case, you know, if anything ever happened to us on Earth, well, at least some semblance of the Earth and the human civilization would continue. And maybe it's like that. I mean, if you look, for example, at how throughout numerous cultures, blood is viewed as being sacred and so important. You know, we find this in countless cultures, countless religions, the nature of blood, almost like the religious and the almost magical nature with which it's sort of revered and so forth. You have to wonder, is that just down to, you know, random coincidence when it's, you know, the same across continents, or is there something else going on? Is there something in our distant past that made the ancients know that blood was something extremely important? You know, and this sort of perhaps brings us to these stories of how suddenly we had, you know, people popping up who lived to extraordinary lengths of time. You know, people talk about biblical accounts like Noah and Methuselah. On the one hand, you have the people who take the stories literally, other people who say just nonsense. I'm kind of in between the idea that, and I would take a more scientific approach, well, maybe they did have extended lifespans. You know, if we look at our world today, a lot of research is being undertaken to try and understand how and why our bodies, you know, after a while start to degrade. You know, not to be depressing, but it is a fact that from the moment we're born, we're going to die, you know, and right. We have sort of a time limit of, I guess, today, sort of the upper 80s. You know, it's getting higher, but it's slowing down. You know, it's peaking at sort of that 85, 88, 90 range. But if we could find a way to ensure that, you know, the human body, cells, DNA, etc., didn't degrade, didn't age, and we could essentially freeze it at a certain point, then by default you would have immortality. You know, there's no, if we could demonstrate that, you know, all our problems would be solved, apart from, of course, overpopulation, if nobody ever died, you know.
Problem.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there are issues like that. However, I do wonder if, you know, because we hear these stories of the Anunnaki having incredible lifespans, and then we find, you know, ancient kings, you know, from archaic texts and things like this, living to 130, 140. You know, Methuselah, like I said, Noah. I kind of put a thread through all this and try and sort of weave it together from the perspective of genetic manipulation. And I think, you know, that, as I said, that, to come back to your point, that issue of ruling by proxy, I think, could be a potential answer. And also, you know, I do wonder if possibly today, we hear these stories of the Greys and abductions and hybrids. You know, I do wonder and speculate in the book if the Anunnaki reached a point where they did start to degrade, and whereas before they genetically changed us to create a slave race, perhaps now, rather ironically, they're genetically using us because they're reliant on us to survive. You know, it's like the tables have been turned almost.
Right. No, yeah, I want to get into the abductions here in a second. Do you think that at some point you kind of touched upon this a little while ago. Do you think there may be a period where there's an awakening among the Rh negatives, where they're a kind of a collective knowing that they're a superior group, and that maybe some genetic code opens and all of a sudden they're like, okay, we have this specific work to do?
Well, you know, I mean, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, kind of almost like, you know, sort of Dawn of the Dead, you know, we all wake up one morning and there's these Rh negatives running around, you know, taking over or whatever. I actually haven't seen any evidence of that. But what I have seen evidence of, like I said, is that Rh negatives, I know a lot of Rh negatives, and particularly during the course when I was researching the book and writing it, I spoke to a tremendous number who did feel, like you said, they felt they had some sort of task to perform, but they didn't know what it was. It was, you know, it's kind of like when you wake up, you've had a dream, and as you start to wake up, it goes out of your mind bit by bit till it's gone. You know, you can't get it back. That's how they feel, that they know there's something going on with them, that there's something they have to do, but right now, at least, they don't know what it is, but they do feel drawn to investigate and look at these issues. So, you know, I mean, I stress this in the book, this the whole idea in the conclusion about if it were proven that the Rh negatives were some sort of, you know, ancient alien lineage, would it create mass hysteria? You know, I mean, I don't live far, I live like 20 miles from downtown Dallas, and everyone will remember when the whole Ebola thing broke out, you know, not too long ago. We had the guy who flew in and died. Then, you know, two of the nurses got sick, but fortunately recovered.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah,
but before the recovery happened, I mean, you can still find the stories on the internet now. They were talking about, you know, it was, again, it was like at The Walking Dead. They wanted the people shouting, Dallas has got to be quarantined, martial law has got to be put in place. So people even talking about, you know, like 20-foot-tall barbed wire barricades to prevent anybody getting out the city, you know. And then what happened? Well, the one guy died and the two nurses recovered and everybody forgot about it. And so I point out in the book, although I don't think it's justified, I could well understand how in a hypothetical situation there would be a degree of hysteria, concern and suspicion about the Rh negatives, even though, as I said, it's not like they're a silent army where they're all secretly talking to each other or, you know, about some planned takeover. No. But, I do find it interesting that they do feel, so many of them do feel they have a role to play in something, you know. And for me, that's about as far as I can take it, you know. I mean, if you ask me, do I think they're all subliminally programmed and they're all going to wake up one day and, you know, and do whatever? No, I don't think that's going to happen, because I think, you know, if even if there is like an alien lineage, the big irony, again, to use that word again, is that they don't know. That's the point. It's not like they're genetically created things to infiltrate us. They're human beings who, you know, just may be related to something that 30 or 40,000 years ago was genetically altered, and that's all they know.
Yeah, it's just the lineage. Let's talk about the whole alien abduction phenomenon, and how do you, because you talk about it quite a bit in the book, and I understand it. I had Bud Hopkins on the number of conferences, and he is not with us any longer, but he wrote a lot in the 80s about the abduction experience, and all these American these people were going through these horrific experiences, and a lot of them seem to be based on reproduction, the reproduction of a fetus, or planting what seemed to be possible DNA or something into these women. What do you think the link is of the Rh negative controversy with alien abduction?
Well, you know, I mean, just before we sort of get to the abduction, I mean, one of the things I discuss in the book before the abduction, these sort of earlier incarnations, if you like, of abduction, such as talking about the, you know, the stories of Lilith, you know, depending on whose story or inversion you interpret correctly or not, you know, some people view Lilith as like a demonic entity, others as Adam's first wife. And, you know, the list goes on. But essentially, Lilith was sort of this predatory supernatural entity that would steal babies, steal male sperm, you know, and you had this reproductive aspect. And it was all done to allow Lilith to create these sort of hideous or monstrous offspring, you know, that were half derived from male sperm and half from Lilith herself. You know, that actually sounds quite like today's hybrids and, you know, what's going on with abductions. I also talk a bit about the whole issue of incubus and succubus, you know, which I mean, some people obviously take the view that it's like an internal mechanism of the human mind, you know, no external angle at all. I'm not sure that is the case personally. In fact, I don't think it is. But other people take sort of a more of a supernatural approach, you know, with incubus and succubus. So that's open to debate. But again, it relates to like a sexual angle between, you know, supernatural beings in the middle of the night and men and women in the beds. So again, you have clear parallels. That leads then into sort of the fairy and little people culture of the Middle Ages, where, you know, people would talk about being taken to the fairy kingdom and males having to mate with the fairy queen. They leave and come back and, you know, 2 days has gone by instead of 2 hours. And so you've got a missing time angle. You've got a reproductive angle. And then, of course, one of the other similarities there as well is that there are a lot of ancient stories of the fairies supposedly being blighted. You know, they couldn't reproduce well, so they would use human stock, so to speak. For me, all these parallels come together and are suggestive, at least, of the people of the various eras trying to interpret these events in ways that were relevant to them, in the same way we do that today with abductions. And, of course, that leads into the whole abduction angle. Now, when you talk about the links between the Rh negatives and alien abductions, I mentioned earlier about how a higher than normal percentage of Rh negatives have an extra vertebra in the back. Well, it turns out if you look at one of the most famous of all abductions, if not the most famous one, the Betty and Barney Hill case of 1961.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when Betty and Barney were abducted, taken on board, you know, in the immediate aftermath, they had these weird dreams, knew something had happened, but weren't entirely sure what, which is like a lot of people today who have abduction stories. They know something happened to them, they can't put the finger on it, they have weird dreams and nightmares. So ultimately, they decided to have regressive hypnosis. And it turns out that when, I mean, a lot of unusual and interesting stuff came out during the course of the various hypnosis sessions. One of the things that came out that was really interesting was that Barney Hill said that at one point the aliens were running their fingers up and down his spine, and he wondered if they were actually counting his vertebra, which, you know, bear in mind this was 61, John Fuller's book on the subject, The Interrupted Journey, came out in 65. So we're talking early to mid-60s when all the hypnosis was going on. This is way before anyone was talking about Rh negatives and extra vertebra. And yet Barney himself actually speculated, well, you know, why were they, you know, it sounds like they were counting my vertebra. Why would they do that? And then, of course, that leads into today's stuff, where, you know, it's gone certainly since the 90s from just abductions and missing time to where we're now talking about hybrids, you know, either for our benefit, their benefit from a positive aspect, or as David Jacobs suggests, like an extremely sinister motivation of creating hybrids that look more and more like us and that can move amongst us and literally infiltrate us. And then from there we have, you know, the rise of the so-called black-eyed children in the last couple of years. So I focus on this as to how, since the days of Betty and Barney Hill through the 70s and the 80s, where it was more medical experimentation, taking samples, etc., now it seems to be surrounded by stories of actual creation of strange offspring and things like this. And then it's gone to the, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, people were talking about seeing these strange babies and children in sort of tanks, in rooms, on UFOs. Now people are talking about seeing them on the street late at night, you know, hoodies pulled down or collars up and hats pulled down and sunglasses and actually infiltrating the cities. You know, it's almost like a progressive thing if it's, you know, if it's all true.
Yeah. It's funny because David Jacobs does kind of the negative side, and then John Mack was much more positive and linked it to these abductions to more of a spiritual unfolding for the individuals who are experiencing them. And he traveled all over the world to report these. What did you find anything specific regarding his research that kind of ties into the Rh negatives, or is it more just the fact that these people were experiencing these abductions?
Well, yeah, I mean, you make a good point because, you know, I mean, John Mack and certainly Bud Hopkins, you know, were both dead, both men dead now, but both of them were, you know, two of the leading researchers, as still is David Jacobs, and they all had different approaches. You know, Hopkins took a more of a positive approach, but again, you know, was focused on this reproductive angle. As I said, Jacobs took a far more sinister approach with the hybrids and infiltration. And you're right, with John Mack, a lot of the people he spoke to and his conclusions were sort of down this spiritual pathway. And he also noted the sort of transformative effect that abductions often had on people from a positive perspective. Now, I've spoken to other people, on the other hand, who've said that, well, they do that deliberately to lull us into a false sense of security, you know, so you can go down two paths. But one of the things I did find interesting about, you know, Mac was that he spoke to quite a few people who felt that these entities, good, bad or indifferent, were somehow fascinated by and had a direct need to sort of look into the whole issue of the human soul or the life force and try and figure out, you know, they seem to have some sort of linkage to the whole issue of the soul or knew what it was. And again, you have people who view this from a positive perspective, you know, that they're trying to demonstrate that there is a soul, there is an afterlife, and, you know, who knows what it is. On the other hand, I've heard all sorts of horror stories, the idea that the human soul can actually almost be used as like a life force, as like an energy. In other words, you know, we're a herd to be sort of culled when we die, you know, they don't care about our physical bodies. It's almost, you know, the human soul they're after. The closest analogy probably being something like in the Matrix movies, you know, where we're all lying in tanks, not realizing it's not the real world, you know, and the machines are harvesting our electrical energy. That's one of the theories about the whole soul angle of abductions, that essentially they're farming human souls. So, you know, it gets down into some interesting and positive areas, but it also gets into some pretty bleak areas
as well.
That's pretty
dark, Nick. That's pretty dark discussion there, using us for energy.
I mean, it's hypothetical, obviously, because number one, we have to prove there's a soul. Number two, you know, we have to prove that it can actually be digested, to use a simple term. But I mean, one of the things that was said to me by somebody on this was, you know, the aliens are always telling us not to blow each other up, and we think that's because they love us. Well, maybe it's because, well, what are they going to do if we blow ourselves up? You know, they've got no food supply. It's like the farmer worrying that if somebody blows up his cows, he's going to have no food, or, you know, his business is going to go out of business. And it's kind of the same sort of scenario, that they may actually want us around forever, not because they love us or they're worried what we're doing to the planet, but because they're a resource to us. Now, I wouldn't want people to have nightmares, because, you know, we don't know that's true. But what we do know is that, I mean, particularly Whitley Strieber, he talked about how he felt these entities, whether they're extraterrestrial or something stranger that we can't even comprehend, he felt they had sort of a deep knowledge of life after death and the soul. And he felt they could possibly even operate in our physical realm and also in sort of the realm or dimension of the dead, if you like.
So you're fundamentally impressed enough to think that these Rh negatives are a manipulated species of human being. What about the rest of us? I mean, there are, I think even science today, there's a number of missing links between the early apes, and then all of a sudden here's a Homo erectus, Homo sapien, which is the modern man. I mean, are you of a belief that the rest of us evolved naturally, or was there some intervention? I mean,
Well, I mean, you're right. There are, we do have, you know, you can take the Rh negative small percentage out of the picture, and we still have a lot of weird anomalies about leaps and jumps and development of species and things like this and how it all kicked off. So it's not impossible that, you know, we could all be the product of genetic manipulation, but it could be the case that with the Rh negative, some of them were refined in different areas. Now, you know, some people might roll their eyes at that, but the fact is that's precisely what we're looking into now. I mean, for example, and again, I use the old legends as a springboard to show people how we're doing this today. For example, you know, experiments to create artificial wombs where, you know, babies can essentially be grown outside of the mother and designer babies. And also, you know, there was a big outcry in the UK a few years ago when it was shown that human embryos, you know, in the UK there are strict laws about how long a human embryo can be kept alive and dabbled with, basically. And it's, you know, it's a handful of days. But recent stories surfaced in the British media about how certain scientists were using human embryos and looking at the idea of actually sort of splicing these embryos with, you know, with animal DNA just to see if it was feasible. Now, as I said, the laws stipulate, well, they've got to be destroyed. But, you know, it's inevitable the day is going to come when somebody doesn't destroy one of these things and they're just going to take it as far as it can go. So if we're now planning things like that and we know it's potentially feasible, that's why I think it's far more than feasible that somebody else could have done exactly the same thing to us. It's not far out at all.
It's an amazing thought. Obviously, you believe in off-world beings. Is it your feeling that in your research, they've been here as long as Sitchin has described? I mean, they came here 400,000 years ago to create a slave race to dig their caves to get their gold and other precious metals. But, I mean, UFO sightings are constant. The abduction phenomenon is conscious and it's repressed and not widely reported. So you must feel that these off-world beings are still coming and working with us in some capacity.
Yeah, I mean, to the point you made first about, you know, do I think it goes as far back as Sitchin suggested? Where I would differ with him is I would sort of take not so much a conservative approach to the date, but a conservative approach to how we define the date. And I would suggest that when we're able to build a picture of when Cro-Magnon man first surfaced, sort of 45,000 years ago, depending on who you ask, that would then lead me to believe, well, they had to have been around at least at that point. You see what I mean? Rather than just say, oh, well, I'm just going to pick a figure out, I try and apply a bit of logic and say, well, you know, if they were manipulating Cro-Magnon man, they got to have been here sort of 45,000-50,000 years ago. Now, if, as Sitchin suggested, they were doing this way back when, you know, the very earliest proto-human, sort of 3 to 4 foot tall, erect, ape-like creatures in Africa, then yes, we would be pushing it back, you know, really, you know, to sort of six figures, you know, 100,000 or whatever, or even more. So, you know, I certainly would suggest a period in the tens and tens of thousands, because that's the only way to make that theory work. You know, it's not a case of wanting to the evidence to fit. It's just more the logic of, well, if we know when Cro-Magnon man surfaced, you know, that they had to be doing something then. And I think, you know, a good case can be made. And granted, you know, I'll be the first to admit it is all theoretical, but I do believe a good case can be made that when we look at these ancient stories of the gods coming down and, you know, significant changes to humans and lifespans and things like this, you know, crossbreeding, the gods coming down, etc., we can make clear parallels, I think, between what's going on today with abductions and of somebody coming down, and there's a reproductive angle. That's an important part of, you know, verifying the story, or at least, you know, demonstrating that it's viable.
Mm. In the few minutes we have left, Nick, what are you hoping the reader gets from this book? Because it's fascinating, it's well written, and you document a lot of material. Are you hoping that the reader thinks twice about? I mean, who among us walks around the street and goes, "Oh, that's an Rh negative. Oh, that's an Rh negative." I mean, we don't know.
Yeah.
There's no way to know because that's the most tightly kept, personal thing. I mean, I don't even know what my blood type is.
Well, actually, people inevitably, that's a question I keep getting asked, and I got to find out, I suppose.
But what would you say? What would you say? I mean, because this is an important piece of writing, and obviously, I mean, if I were to guess, I'd say that Nick Redfern is trying to intimate the fact that there could be a group of people who are slowly becoming aware of their existence, that they are different, and at some trigger point, something's going to snap in their RNA or DNA, and they're going to have an awareness that they need to start doing something, and all of a sudden, either good things are going to happen, or it's going to be a shift in evolution, or I mean, what? Oh, tell me, what do you think?
I mean, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I'll be honest with you. What I think for sure, or what I know for sure in speaking to people, is that so many of the Rh negatives do feel drawn to UFO phenomena, to learn about it, to experience, the phenomena. Even if they haven't experienced it, just to try and get closer to it and understand it. And then sometimes when they do that, they actually find afterwards that they did have experiences. Now, as far as, like I said, them suddenly all one day we wake up and the Rh negatives are running around, doing this and altering civilization. I personally don't think that, there's going to be like a light switch flicked and then suddenly they all leave the house and meet up somewhere and, somebody does this and somebody does that. I don't think that's going to happen. I do think it's possible that we may, with a substantial, and greater awareness and more data, I think it may well come round to being proved or provable that, the theory has merit. Now, of course, as I said, I'm sure that would create, in sort of feeble-minded people who just look, dumb racists or whatever, they're just going to whip up hysteria for the sake of it. I think that's one of the unfortunate side effects. But that doesn't say anything about the Rh negatives. That just says a great deal about the idiotic nature of the people who would, take that approach. My view is that they're not sort of like a sinister underground army in the slightest. Now, that's for the average Rh negative, which is, 95, 96% of them. However, I wouldn't be at all surprised if in some of these sort of powerful secret orders and, royal institutions, I wouldn't be at all surprised if some sort of ancient secret knowledge has been passed down and there's a determination on their part to keep their bloodline Rh negative as a means to continue the original lineage, from X number of thousands of years ago. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But I think, that's sort of the more sinister elite rather than the average Rh member of the population, which are, aren't any different to the rest of us. So, you can look at it in different ways. But I think, obviously the past is in the past, as fascinating as it is. What's relevant to us is the present and the future. And I do think there could well be something sinister about this whole rise of stories of hybrids and infiltration and the black-eyed children. All this kind of thing does make me wonder if, there's like another step and another stage. And right now, obviously, we're not seeing what another step or stage is, but it doesn't mean it's not out there. So what I hope, the book will achieve is that it will demonstrate to people the uniqueness of the Rh negatives, the importance of them in terms of our history and our lost history. And also, I would hope people realize it provides sort of pretty unique look at an aspect of the UFO subject, which has largely gone under the radar, apart from, you know, the occasional article here or the occasional lecture there or whatever. And hopefully it will also, as the debate continues, open more doors to what's going on. You know, the more and more pieces we can put together, the more the jigsaw is going to look like a picture rather than just random images, you know. So I think I sort of view the book, hopefully, as like a springboard rather than just like a standalone book. And then, you know, I hope like a springboard to people who are H-negative to look at themselves, other people to find out if they are. And then we can get a bigger debate going. I think that's sort of an important thing.
Interesting. Well, the book is called Bloodline of the Gods, Unravel the Mystery of the Human Blood Type to Reveal the Aliens Among Us. I think it's fascinating. The cover is quite expressive. And my guest today has been Nick Redfern. Nick, thank you for joining us. Where can we see? Are you going to be speaking on this book this coming fall? Are you going to probably be touring?
I'm not sure I'll actually be talking on this book or not. I've actually got a few books out right now, but I'll be speaking at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis in the first weekend of October. Second weekend of October, I'll be at the Texas Bigfoot Conference. And the third weekend in October, where I actually will be speaking on this book, or at least touching on it, I'll be at the New Mexico MUFON Conference. So, but I shall certainly bring it up in the lectures, you know, because people often want to know what, you know, your latest things are. So.
Right. Fantastic. Okay. Give us your web address again. I want to make sure we post that so people can see what you're up to on your website.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Well, if people type in Nick Redfern plus World of Whatever, that'll automatically take you to the top. The top post will be my blog, rather than sort of have to people write down the whole blog address. But if they type in Nick Redfern World of Whatever, they can reach me there, or just type in Nick Redfern at Facebook or Twitter. You know, I'm always happy to chat with people if they've got any questions or want to share information. Again, you know, always happy to chat.
Okay, great. And hey, best of luck on this book. It's a real thriller to read, and I'm enjoying
Chris.
It.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Okay, well, that's been our guest today. The book again is Bloodline of the Gods, and I think it's not quite available yet. I think it's going to come out in a few weeks. But check on Amazon, of course, and the publisher is New Page Books, and you can go to New Page, and they may have an early copy of it. So be looking for it there. So that's it for today, and I will talk to you guys next week.